We have a microphone here for anyone who would like to do so after our panelists get a freebie, a chance to speak on whatever they would like. So please, whoever would like to go first.
What are you looking at me?
Okay. You're the first one. You follow.
That was a very
That was amazing to put together a very.
Is this working? Okay. Yes. So, I'm not very serious about that. Outside of a hermeneutic to think about other problematics, but I'm on the record already about the fetishism of transparency. An example that I used at the MLA a couple of years ago was the archive of immigrant communities crossing the border of the United States that communicate through WhatsApp, scraps of paper, encrypted communication that can never be offered as an archive. We wouldn't want to endanger the lives of these people. As an immigrant myself, I'm now in a list of being kept by the State Department for that gives them license to read my archive on Facebook mm-hmm. and my archive on Twitter. So yes, of course not. We should always maintain divisions of privacy and publicness that protect us until that moment when humanity arrives at some universal notion of justice that works for everybody, which is not happening in our time, right? So when I speak of understanding of this kind of like non-discipline that understands knowledge production today, I speak too of that, of those hidden texts that we study without presenting them, without representing them. One of the technologies that we developed at the lab, for example, was followed a visit to Cuba in which we learned that they had only 10% penetration to an internet and 1% penetration to the internet. This was before Obama, towards the end, kind of opened it up. And issues about the last mile, the connection between the big servers to the homes of people. One of the things that scholars were doing down there was passing around USBs to each other with essays from JSTOR and stuff like that that people like us would bring from overseas. And some people were creating publications on email chains, especially in LGBT studies and radical race studies, because this was the only way that to leverage the servers to publish something the government itself is not particularly radical about, right? So one of the technologies we developed was a way to build these kind of digital archives that we like on USBs. So I'm guessing that we all imagine transparency in terms of the internet, but I guess there are degrees of transparency at which the knowledge production is working today de facto. And this is what I want us to think about, these kind of all the levels of transparencies at which the reality of the record is manifesting today in a finite way. There is no infinite here. This is why it's encouraging, even if it's like half joking. There's a kind of seriousness in the knowledge that this is finite and it's happening.
No.
Well, thank you very much for your comment. I think this was a real tour de force, no, that you made, because these papers coincided, as you showed, in conceptual terms, but they were very different, and so this was like a very interesting to see how you managed to really bring these concepts forward. So thank you very much. Very briefly, I think what I wanted to transmit here, in the beginning, there was an intense discussion about digitalization, about preservation, and I think in this little story, what I wanted to say is the symbolic, material, and political consequences of archives, no? And how images begin in a certain way and what their trajectories are. And this is what I wanted to, this is why this little story was told. These images begin in the north, in the mid of in the early decades of Brazil. They go to Paris, they go to Rio, they're intercepted, so on and so forth. So the real, that when we speak of politics, it's not just the politics of assets. It's not just the politics of who manages the funding. It's also a very concrete issues of who is being able to have a certain empowerment in relation to these archives. So that's what I was kind of saying. And what we're seeing here is a kind of, what we saw was a kind of a silencing of the Indian subject that then arises, but these people that occupied these, you know, the museum grounds, they're not necessarily the Indian voice. They're just a representative of one thing. And so there's a power struggle that is going on around issues of identity, empowerment, access, and this is what makes the archive alive. And this is what makes the haunting of the pictures come back to us and kind of question us and say, look, these are dead Nambiquaras that no longer exist, but the Nambiquaras are still there. What does this mean? What is this trajectory, right? And so this is kind of a thick interpretation that I wanted to bring forth. So it's not just technical issues, you know, or material issues of, oh, we haven't preserved the newspaper from 19, whatever, whatever. These are very, like, urgent political matters at stake. No? That's basically it.
Well, thank you very much for these comments. I think I would like to comment on the global and national link, although I didn't mention that in my thing very strongly. But, you know, the cluster we are doing in Heidelberg that is exactly dealing with this question. Now, if I sort of may spell out some like two simplistic rules, and then the one is, of course, that transcultural interaction is the lifeline of any culture. You know, without that, it dies and dries up. Second is, culture is also the anchor of identity. And so the consequence of that is a wonderful double-decker. Number one, you take anything you think useful and do with it whatever you want. And number two, you deny you ever did. So, and that means that from, you see that in the Chinese case very simply, you know, you have, let's say, one of our big collections is, or efforts at collection is foreign language newspapers published in Republican China in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Now, they were, as a matter of fact, the main part of the Chinese public domain. But they're written out of Chinese newspaper history because they're not Chinese. Although most Chinese papers derive both their national and their international use from the foreign language papers, right? Because it is just obviously cultural imperialism. So, now, the main point, however, is that you get a type which is a part of the historical past. You get a huge amount of information asymmetry between what China knows just not only about the world, but about itself. Namely, you look at the knowledge of, let's say, available in Great Britain on China in 1900, and the knowledge you could get in China itself on many questions of Chinese, not all of them, but quite a lot of them, you would find an asymmetry which is overwhelming. I give you a simple example. You want to know something about the navigable rivers and coastline of China. Well, you know, you look at all the shipping records you can have in Chinese, and you will find, you know, they, as a matter of fact, will not tell you where are the main obstacles in the rivers, where are the main obstacles on the coastline. These are just sort of experiential things which people knew how to handle. So what happens is, you know, the British Admiralty produces the China Coast Handbook, you know, which is updated every year by handing in from captains, you know, who were driving around there. And, well, then you translate that into Chinese in 1902, and add a big preface and says, what kind of a place are we that we don't even produce a handbook of our own rivers and coastline, you know, but have to translate from somewhere else? And this is not the only thing. You deal with Chinese history. First Chinese history is written by Nakamichi in Japanese, right, in 1896. You know, happened in, he wrote it in Chinese, you know, which is the classic language in Japan too. So again, you get this preface and says, what is going on here? So you have a kind of a heritage of sort of self-knowledge, you know, asymmetry in self-knowledge. And now you can say, well, that's all imperialism and cultural imperialism and so on and so forth. But we, of course, are doing exactly the same thing. Namely, what we have now in situation is that on many of the most controversial and difficult parts of PRC history, modern Chinese history, let's say the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, the Tiananmen events in 89, the information you will find at the University of Chicago, Heidelberg, or Stanford, or you name it, you know, is five times better than anything anybody, including high-ranking party members in China, would have access to. So you have a type of information asymmetry which is now maintained under completely different conditions, and people who want to study that from China try to get some way to come to our library or to Harvard or wherever it is, you know, and then what you see, what you expect them to do is they read all the kind of foreign language stuff. They do that too. But what they mostly do is hunt for Chinese documents to which they themselves don't have access in their own country. So you have a type of a linkage, you know, between the global and the national, which is getting ever more bizarre, you know, and maybe you have a type of maintaining information asymmetry, which is maintained by people who have no imperialist ambition whatsoever, but who have, as a matter of fact, an ambition of saying, well, China or Asia altogether is something like the experimental lab of the 20th century, you know, where you have, I'm stopping straight away. Experimental lab, 20th century, you know. You have anything there from a socialist state which runs a capitalist economy, you know, to ISIS, you know, to the biggest democracy of the world, you know, so everything is there, you know, and all played out at breathtaking speed, you know. And, well, therefore, I think the responsibility to maintain this historical record is a huge one, you know. And what is done locally, and that is, as a matter of fact, for other reasons too, in India, Indonesia, Thailand, wherever you go, you know, is just maintaining a level of informational asymmetry, which is painful, but a fact, and at the present moment, an unavoidable fact.
No, that's okay. Let's see. I mean, I think that there is a way to tie together the globalism, the loss, and the transparency questions. I don't know if I can pull it off. I think that transparency has become, in the 21st century, what the idea of good governance was in the 80s and 90s, namely a kind of audit metric by which self-anointed, developed societies pass judgment upon and condition aid to so-called less developed societies. So there's this tendency that is evolved to kind of use transparency as a kind of barometer for democracy that I think is problematic for a bunch of different reasons. You know, you think of the work of an organization like Transparency International, which is a quite reactionary organization actually, and sort of takes upon itself to decide basically which political systems are more evolved than others, and then to, you know, basically allocate resources accordingly. So that's one way in which it's a problem. Another way in which it's a problem is, you know, in the Cold War context in Latin America, which is kind of specific, but secrecy was the tool used by dissidents to protect themselves and to organize against state repression. So secrecy can be, in the hands of state powers, you know, a very dangerous thing, but it can be palliative, it can be defensive, it can be liberating for other kinds of communities. And if you take that away from people, the ability to have anonymity, the ability to be untraceable, the right to be forgotten, then I think you really run into a whole welter of issues, some of which have to do with, you know, police archives and that kind of stuff, but others of which have to do with the sort of the ways in which we live, all of us, both as physical embodied persons standing on the earth, but also as constellations of bits and bytes in different configurations on the internet and on digital platforms. So And then I think, you know, the final thing would be, and I think to intersect a little bit with Alex's presentation, you know, the means of historical production are ever expanding and have been democratized or at least made more accessible to a great extent, right? Where it used to be that, you know, literacy has massively expanded, the tools with which we can write our own stories or write our own Tumblr blogs about our own stories or whatever it happens to be have massively expanded, but that doesn't deal with the question of who owns those means of historical production. And increasingly, so we all have more access to the means of historical production, but we don't have more ownership over it. And that is another kind of angle that I think intersects with the sorts of inequalities that Professor Reiner just mentioned, and also the kinds of questions of corporate ownership and access that Alex talked about. And then the political question that came up in Beatrice's presentation, right, which is sort of who is going to assert and who can actually exercise the ownership of the means of representation of an entire indigenous culture or society. And so that doesn't really do the work of tying all three of the things together, but it's the end of the day. So that's what I got.
If people have questions, please come up to the microphone.
Thank you very much. This has been a great, great session. Someone who was here earlier left me a note, which I'll archive, asking me to ask this question, and wrote out the question. I think it was a student, and she said that during this morning session, either Mr. Blake or Ms. Frampton, Tom Blake or Professor Frampton, raised the question of the survival of libraries themselves by saying, use is the thing that drives institutional survival, use. I would like to ask what kind of use it is to which we are referring when we make statements like this, and whether we might consider that digital humanities projects are also used by those who participate in their creation. How can the process of creating a digital archive become more functional as a component of an education in the humanities? And then she adds, this question comes from an individual who works on the front lines of harvesting data, who wonders about the implications for students of the humanities in the fact that such work has become anonymous. So I think this is a question about the pedagogical use of archives and specifically about the uses of constructing a digital archive. Seems to me a very good one. Does anyone have any thoughts on that? Thank you.
Hi, is this working?
Yep.
So I think the construction of a digital archive that focuses on teaching a full stack can allow us to teach students how to be that group that can take over the means of production of its own knowledge away from the corporations. The only way that is going to happen is if we have large numbers of memory workers, cultural workers around the world, and this has to happen outside of institutions because most of the world can't pay good enough. I can't go back to the Dominican Republic teach there because I'll starve. That doesn't mean that there isn't scholarship happening right now in the Dominican Republic. It's just people have day jobs at banks, magazines, etc. And in the evening and in the weekends, these citizen scholars do history and literary criticism and produce archives. Alas, globally, and this I'll gesture that for the most part, we are using platforms that are created and owned by others who use our data as the most important new form of currency in the planet. If we work with our students, ourselves first, to learn how to do full stack development of digital archives and teach our students how to do this, different levels of the scale of transparency, not only through the internet, but also understanding material embodied reality and how technologies play out outside of the internet. I think we have a chance. A small chance, because I'm very pessimistic. I think we're going to fail miserably. And corporations are going to keep on trading data about us, and they're going to keep on owning the record, and we are going to remain locked in the predicament we find ourselves in. But that small chance makes it worth it, I think.
Hi. Thanks for your great talks. I want to think about potential connections between the citizen scholar and this figure you mentioned, the first speaker mentioned, that of the pirate. I wonder if you could go back to that comment you made very briefly and think a little bit about how we can look to these, particularly these people you were in touch with, I gather, in Eastern Europe, and wonder if there's a way to benefit from some of the platforms, some of the technologies that they developed. Thinking also more broadly about the figure of the pirate, you know, if you are taking a USB drive into Cuba illegally, you know, there's a kind of contraband element there as well. Is the pirate at some level a kind of figure of resistance potentially? And obviously we can't necessarily take advantage of the illegally copied and distributed materials that the sort of traditional digital pirate is making available, but is there a way to tap into the technologies that they've begun to develop? Because I think you alluded to more streamlined systems, smaller groups of people working together. I mean, it is a legitimate question. Are they doing things that we could learn from without necessarily entering ourselves into situations of breaking the law or operating at the edges of the law?
Mm. So Vika commented when we went out to get coffee that I actually just mentioned pirate libraries and didn't elaborate on what those are. Is everybody familiar with what the pirate libraries are? These are ARG, LibGen, Sci-Hub. These are where most of our graduate students get their papers and their ebooks. I myself got the literature for classes when I was a graduate student from many of these libraries because I'm already borrowing too much money to get a PhD, and that is the case of most of our students. We have at Columbia, as part of our group for experimental methods, we divide ourselves into mini labs, and one of them is the piracy lab. So we've been studying this phenomenon and participating in those communities. Yes, I do believe in a very romantic way. As someone who grew up on Star Wars and reading comic books, that the figure of the pirate, of the Robin Hood, of the immigrant border crosser, these are very promising figures of resistance. Mostly because they imagine a world outside of what the libraries are imagining themselves to be right now. I have argued elsewhere that modern research libraries are nothing but performers of the law, and in particular of copyright law. They perform it more than anybody else in the academic ecosystem. And in fact, the whole existence is built around the performance, in the Judith Butler sense of the word, of copyright law. They bring it into being more than any other structure in the planet right now. For us, if we are to get out of this mess, I believe the pirate flag, the Jolly Roger, might be one of those metaphors we wanna explore and pursue.
Can I just add on to that people have to be willing to fight for access to information, control over information, the ability to enjoy fractions of the kinds of technologies and the forms of power that we operate as the subjects of, you know, every minute of our lives. So, you know, if you think about, you know, I coming from a very different angle, which is much less digital, but has to do with the sort of activism in Latin America, like what folks did in order to kind of fight for the release of these sorts of documents was essentially perform civil disobedience. And that is, I suspect, the ethos behind this kind of, you know, the language of the pirate in the digital humanities world, where if there is a law, if you see a law that is unjust, then you have to bridge the gap between the law and justice with your own actions. And, you know, you can take that as an endorsement of whatever you want. But this is not the kind of, like, that kind of power is not ever given up freely as an act of charity from above. It is always fought for by different kinds of organized, mobilized communities, usually operating with secrecy as one of their core tools, and they oblige, right? They force disclosure by making a demand. So that's all I'll say about that. Yeah.
Could I add a little word to that? I mean, one of the sort of generational differences, which, as a matter of fact, we have not been addressing here, is, of course, that most of the records we have been dealing with, or many of the records we have been dealing with, are pre-1917 records. That is essentially those interesting for historians, and archival records, which also go under the same copyright law. You look at, go to Hathi, something like that, you know, the 1917 sort of a deadline is a hard one, you know, and the same is true for, I don't know, Google and something like that. So now the generational shift is that somehow this is what libraries are in a way bound to maintain, and the university lawyers tend to go overdrive, you know, to enforce that, you know. I remember we had a wonderful situation in the University of Göttingen, which bought some years ago a big pack of multilingual journals from Xinjiang province. You know, they were in Uyghur and Kyrgyz and Russian and so on and so forth from the 30s and 40s. So, and they, and then there have been now a big trend in study of the Qing dynasty, as a matter of fact, as a multilingual, multi-ethnic empire, the new Qing history in a way. So there was a big ask, get that stuff digitized. We can't all go to Göttingen to file through that stuff, you know. Then they did one thing before asking me what to do. They went to their lawyer. And the lawyers, it's very simple, you know. You have to get every single author who wrote one of these articles in the 20s and 30s, you know, if he's surviving, get his permission to scan it, if not his descendants to do so, you know. So, I mean, this is an enterprise, you know, you can forget it, you know. So the point is, nobody has ever heard of a single way that from PRC somebody went to court, you know, to actually challenge, you know, a digitization project, a project of that kind, you know. But on a metaphysical law level, suddenly that is how this operates, you know. And if you look, as a matter of fact, at the real life situation which you have been mentioning, namely, you look at how students operate with that. You know, you tell students, okay, you know, I put the stuff online for you, and they just look at you with kind of a, you know, bare amazement, you know, why you put that stuff online. They find it in 1.5 minutes, what you might have spent 2 hours to find, you know. And you say, you know, there is a movie out 2 weeks ago. Oh, yes, 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 we have seen it online, you know. How they do it, you know, most parents even refuse to acknowledge the existence of that. And the feeling of guilt in terms of accessing LibGen or whatever it might be, you know, is zero, you know. But I mean, I find in our cluster, I remember, you know, one colleague at one moment, you know, marched with the little slips printed out paper through our cluster. There were 200 people working there, you know, and handing out little snippets, you know, for a kind of books inside the copyright law, you know. One good place is to go here, but he didn't want to send the email around, you know, because he felt he would make himself legally liable, you know, but he felt it was relevant information. And I published a book, you know, at Springer, and before I had the print copy in hand, you know, it was already on LibGen, you know. So this is how that goes. And so we have a huge generational divide, you know, of people with skills also of accessing internet sources, you know, which are far beyond at least my generation and probably the next generation after me also, you know, because I see a lot of parents who are something like 40-ish and 50-ish, you know, and they roll their eyes and talking about what their kids get downloaded from the internet, you know. And that's very much of a reality which our libraries somehow do not, dare not, and, well, perhaps cannot deal with.
Thank you all. This was absolutely wonderful. I've learned an enormous amount, also from Mo's conceptualization. So epistemology, Mo raised a question about that. The epistemology of history and how generationally it's changing, because social media is the arena in which young people seek, older people seek to be recognized by someone worth being recognized by. this is going to create all kinds of difficulties epistemologically in figuring out what is going on. So fake news is a problem, but so are the thousands of videos coming out of Syria, which Alexa Koenig at Berkeley is crowdsourcing to her students to try to develop means of verifying those videos, in her case, hopefully to use in a legal context for war crimes. But the doctoring of history, when we talk about images coming in, really raises this epistemological problem for history. And I thought Mo brought up a very interesting question there. So I'm just putting it back on the table. Knowledge, getting the facts.
I studiously avoided the words epistemology in my comments originally, but of course what I propose is a material epistemological exercise. Epistemology understood materially as a series of nodes of access and not access and node and presences there's an argument to be made that can actually help us understand that the history of the world has always been this negotiation between access and not access. I know in the past 20 years in postcolonial studies, from which I cut my teeth, there's been a lot of talk about how linguistics itself and language itself actually carries with it epistemologies that end up winning out. And I work with Professor Gayatri Spivak at Columbia, who's made some really good arguments about how English, it was fated to win in the way it operates linguistically. And our computer systems, we know, are built around English. But I think there was a missed opportunity there in our turn towards language to actually understand this kind of material realities that are finite, relationships of power that are being negotiated right now and that can be traced back through genealogies of the fate of this. Moving archives have been a thing. Human beings have been carrying secret documents in their bags for centuries in every continent. What I propose is that we move forward now, perhaps, I don't think I'm going to convince enough people to do this, but here goes nothing, to understand how those material epistemologies are taking place right now. I'll give you one example of an alternative, and then I'll pass it on real quick. Just my next essay is going to study the plagiarism companies that sell papers to students. I will argue in this paper, it's a co-written with Dennis, we started doing the research already, that in this body of knowledge and another literary criticism exists parallel to the one that we know from conferences and stuff like that. These are, when I was a graduate student, this is something else we also did to feed ourselves. We wrote for these companies at $600, $700 for an essay on Wolf or Eliot or whatever. In that world also, you were free not to have to cite all the things that you know you have to cite in order to go up through the ranks. You could create a more creative way of writing.
Your scholarship was more imaginative.
Yeah, that created an alternative world of literary criticism, sure. Right? And these are secret, hidden archives that are operating right there, right before our eyes, epistemologies that have materialities attached to them.
I can tack on that, you know, we are, for all of the advances made in critical theory over the last, you know, 40, 50 years, we are still seduced by the authority of the written word and the printed thing on the document. And the fact is that the historical, you know, long before the age of fake news, and, you know, the early modernists, if there are any among us, can, you know, speak eloquently about it. I mean, archival documents are full of mistakes, misapprehensions, outright lies, purposeful deceptions, purposeful omissions. They're totally structured by what they see as, you know, archivable and archive-worthy categories of knowledge, categories of people, ways of being in the world. So, you know, the fake news stuff is a kind of, and the sort of fragmentation of the production of information in the Trump moment, I think is just the sort of a new projection of a set of phenomena that are really just about power and the production of knowledge that are as old as the production of knowledge itself that have just assumed new forms. Which is not to say that we shouldn't worry about them or figure out new and more agile ways of conceptualizing them, but I think that there is less novelty to what's going on right now than we might suppose.
This panel is awesome. I like my panelists. They're amazing.
But there are more people engaged, no? There are more people who have access to writing and disseminating than there was before. So that makes a difference.
Yeah, please.
I said I agree entirely, but what I'm saying is that there are many more people who are authoring texts and are intervening and are sending things and are passing information than was before. So when you, in the age of the big newspaper, you had to have access to the big newspaper. You had to have access. So this is like a different public arena. Although people obviously communicate and there are very specific niches and they do not communicate outside their niches, nonetheless, you're having a phenomena of a widespread kind of authorship that is a bit different from what was before. Not that the fake news or whatever didn't exist before, but this idea of authoring, posting, doing, writing, this dissemination.
But it is, I mean, yes, that is true, but I don't think that the fundamental differentials in terms of the allocation of power have actually shifted.
No.
So I think more people are more able to produce content in exchange for nothing than previously, but I think there's actually been a concentration of power that is belied by the multiplicity of voices that we now have some access to, right? Because the question is, you know, at the end of the day, like, follow the money, where's it going? And it's not to the great multiplicity of wonderful voices, you know, dialoguing in the digital humanities platform.
That's the other thing. But there's a feeling of authorship in the air. That is not necessarily, I agree, it's just that there's a feeling of authorship in the air that is the novelty. But that actually in political and empowerment terms doesn't mean very much.
It could. Well, worse than that, it may, maybe worse is a generation that when you say to them, you could unplug from Facebook, and Zuckerberg has to listen, that they regard this as unthinkable. So that authorship may be an illusion also for them.
Yeah.
I would stay away from a concept of generation, which is that they usually just mean white kids in the North Atlantic. The technological ecologies, the ecologies playing out of power relationships that at a planetary level involve many complexities. I think my question to you is, both of you, or all three of you, is do you think we can theorize this? And my approach would be a natural tendency towards the structuralism in which I would come up with models of these relationships, just so to give us something to hold on to, so that we can understand and talk about what is going on. Ryan, do you think it's possible that we would be able to, I don't know the answer to that, that it's possible for us to theorize these relationships across continents?
Well, I can't come up with the theory you require, but with the opposite of it. Would that do? Let's see what the opposite. The opposite is very simple. The opposite are two simple terms, and that is, the key term is sovereignty. And that's sovereignty of information and opinion. So that is the ultimate nation state claim. It's okay, you know, we have sovereignty of information and of opinion. And any outsider who comes in with feeding information or opinion into it is an invader, is an imperialist, is whatever, you know, is a foreign power, whatever it is. That's exactly these two terms. Information sovereignty and opinion sovereignty are Chinese terms, which I herewith introduce to you. So that's exactly the opposite. And then what you do there is buy from the United States, as a matter of fact, the software with which you can develop, you know, this is a software developed to basically scan for ISIS-related information, you know, so then you can tag any information type you don't want to circulate within your firewall, and though you weed it out, you know, very nice, you know, so you maintain information and opinion asymmetry. That's exactly the opposite of what you have been talking about. But you see, you're going to have to define the opponent, you know, and that might be, you know, a singular exception, but it isn't, you know. You look who is now buying the Chinese concept of managing their internet. You look at Saudi Arabia, you look at Pakistan, you look at even Thailand, you look at a lot of other places to say, well, that's very charming, yeah, we like it, you know. This is, as a matter of fact, how it should be, you know. We want to control what is in our internet, you know, and what is accessible to our citizens, and what should not be accessible because it's unhealthy, pornographic, or you name it, you know. And there is, of course, a serious problem in it, you know, because you have the dark internet where, as a matter of fact, a lot of information is flowing around, where, as a matter of fact, any reasonable person would probably expect state authorities to intervene, you know, which happens now here as an example with Facebook or things like that, to intervene to prevent, you know, certain types of information from flowing around, you know. And then you get into the ambivalence, what kind of state institution is that, and so on and so forth. I mean, the mess is just totally overwhelming, you know, because we are now in a situation, Europe, we are discussing that a lot, you know. People are saying, obviously, this is like, I don't know, the train system in the 19th century, you know. You go to England, you know, you have, I don't know, 28 different train companies. They're all running on a different timetable. Literally, I mean, the time in Manchester was a different time as in London, right? And they have all these different trains. You have no idea how they interact, and they're all independent train lines, you know? So, and then eventually say, okay, national integration of that. And so there is a big push to, as a matter of fact, move towards a kind of a state administration of the internet, which technically already is in a way there, because the switches which link, you know, all our computers to the internet, of course, are administered by the various states. We have three of these switches in Germany, you know, and all traffic runs through them, you know. So, and then is the question, you know, what kind of state administers that, you know. So you have the opposite side is there, and it's not just illegal and illegitimate, you know. There is, it has some sort of argument, you know, because the internet itself is basically a platform, and a lot of stuff is flowing around there, you know, which is not very charming.
Please join me in thanking our panelists.